Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Candice LaPage, and we are here again in March. We are in March now. The time just keeps moving so quickly. I can't believe we're already in March. We have already done so many movies. And we've come back around to March again, because March, of course, is when the pandemic started last year, at least here in Canada. It's when the lockdown started here in Ontario. The official one-year day will be March 17th, when Ontario issued the very first state of emergency. So if you're looking for a cause to celebrate this coming March 17th, that may be a bit different than normal St. Patrick's Day festivities. You can always mark the one-year anniversary of the state of emergency. Now, I'm not saying you have to, but it is an option. We're going to talk about other celebrations this week, too. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new teen romance sequel to All the Boys, Always and Forever, which you can now stream on the Netflix. Before we get into All the Boys, though, we do have some movie news to cover, and there was pretty big movie news on Sunday with the 78th annual Golden Globe Awards coming at least a month later than usual, again owing to the pandemic. But of course, it was going to be very famous because it was a physically distant awards. It was Bicoastal Awards. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted. They were on opposite sides of the United States. Amy Poehler was broadcasting from the traditional Golden Globes home at the Beverly Hilton in Los Angeles. And Tina Fey was at the top of the Rock in the Rainbow Room in New York City. So there was, well, to get to the nitty-gritty of the technical awards, I mean, they were not great. There were obvious delays and things. I mean, but, you know, I think a lot of people are making too much of that. It's, you know, are we not used to Zoom culture by now? Are we not used to the teleconference culture? I mean, it would have been more surprising if there were not any technical glitches with the Golden Globes. I mean, it's not a particularly forward-thinking or net-savvy organization. And, of course, we saw a hint of that, and it was referred to multiple times at the award ceremony itself, that the awards were taking place in the shadow of controversy about how the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has no black journalists. If you don't know how the FPA, sorry, I was trying to get the initials worked out, it's a body of like 87 foreign, quote-unquote, foreign journalists, because some of them are not, like, foreign-based, who decide who wins the Golden Globes. This is, the membership has long been sort of shrouded in mystery and sort of the unknown unknowns of how this organization operates or how it chooses members. So it's not particularly surprising that there is no black members of the HFPA. Ugh, those initials. Anyway, if it was something simple like the Golden Globes, but it's not particularly surprising. The membership of the Golden Globes is actually female majority. There are non-white members of the board, but it seems particularly notable that there are no black members, especially after years of complaints about the whiteness of the awards and the award nominees. And it seems like the winners this year were kind of a blowback against that in many respects. So I'm going to just do a quick rundown of some of the winners. So the winner for Best Drama was Nomadland. And the director of that movie, Chloe Zhao, won Best Director. She is only the second woman in the history of the Golden Globes to win Best Director. And that's going to bode fairly well for her Oscar chances. I was ready, willing, and able to put like real money on David Fincher and Mank winning those awards, just because it's Hollywood. It's a movie about the golden age of Hollywood. It's a movie about a making a movie, one of the most famous movies and most critically acclaimed movies of all time, from David Fincher, who's never won an Oscar, but I guess it's not meant to be. Or I mean, that's not a sure thing. The Oscars can be mavericks at times in terms of deciding who gets what award. The question I think that'll be interesting is, will Borat's subsequent movie film get an Oscar nod? It won the Best Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy. Justly deserved, I think. Sacha Baron Cohen won for Best Actor for playing Borat in that film. Sadly, though, Maria Bakalova did not win Best Actress. That went to Rosamund Pike for I Care a Lot. It would have been nice to see Maria Bakalova, because without her, that would not have been as a successful movie. Like, that's real raw comedic talent in that movie, Maria Bakalova. And if there was even a moment's hesitancy about any of the stuff she was asked to do in that movie, the whole thing just would have fallen apart. I think just for boldness, she should have gotten the nod. Perhaps she'll get an Oscar nomination. I don't know. Chadwick Boseman won Best Actor in Absentia posthumously for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Very well deserved. In a surprise move, Audra Day won for The United States versus Billie Holiday, which I believe doesn't come out in Canada until this week. It's going to be out on premium VOD. Of course, No Man's Land isn't out in Canada yet. It was supposed to come out on premium VOD a couple of weeks ago. It is going to get some sort of theatrical run sometime in March, and then it's going to be released onto the Stars channel on Disney Plus sometime in April, to be streamed. I believe that is the course of events right now. Anything can change, and indeed that has changed already. Daniel Kaluuya won for Judas and the Black Messiah. As for Best Supporting Actor, Jodie Foster won for The Mauritanian, which is a small movie that I don't think a lot of people have heard of, and I don't think I heard of it until the Golden Globe nominations came out, because both Jodie Foster and Tahar Rahim were nominated for awards for this movie. So it may be maybe worth trying to make some time to try and find this movie. If the Golden Globes are by any means an Oscar indicator, Jodie Foster winning a supporting actress Oscar, that would make her the second person to win three Oscars. The first, I think, being, I could be wrong, but I believe Meryl Streep also has three. For Best Screenplay, Aaron Sorkin won for Trial of the Chicago 7. It was not his best work, and probably fairly derivative of a lot of Aaron Sorkin's other work. But it's Aaron Sorkin, so this is kind of an example of the occasional laziness and idolatry, let's say, of the Golden Globes. Aaron Sorkin is a heavyweight, so of course he gets an award. There was also praise for Soul, the Pixar movie that is now available on Disney Plus. It won Best Animated Feature, and it won Best Original Score for Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross, and Jean-Baptiste, beating out some pretty big, including Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who were nominated for their Mank score, but also Ludwig Göransson for Tenet, which was a pretty good score, Alexandra Desplat, who's always solid. Those are the movie awards. I'm not going to get into the TV ones. We're not typically a TV radio show. That's a pretty strong indicator of what the Oscars, I think, are going to look like. Those nominations come out later this month, and the Oscar awards show itself is next month in April. I think they're the end of April. Just to cover some more movie news really quick. Tom and Jerry made $33 million worldwide on the weekend. And you're asking yourself, there's a Tom and Jerry movie? Yes, there is. I have not seen any advertising for it on TV, but it somehow made $13.7 million domestically in its first weekend. Interestingly, that is from people booking theaters for private showings of Tom and Jerry. Now, you know, consider me a cinephile snob, but if I was going to book an entire movie theater, it would not be for Tom and Jerry. Anyway, another interesting fact, it's the second best domestic release during the pandemic behind Wonder Woman 1984, which made, where's that number? $16.4 million in its opening weekend. That was also Christmas, so that may have contributed to the success there. And of course, there was a heck of a lot more advertising for Wonder Woman 1984. Again, I have not seen one TV commercial for Tom and Jerry. So where are all these Tom and Jerry heads at? I don't know. It's bizarre. I was not particularly impressed by the trailer. And if you've seen this like movie still going around of Tom the cat advancing on Jerry the mouse, and they're animated, of course, and in the background there's Chloe Moretz is standing there, and people have made the comment that this is an awful looking shot, that the blending of the live action and the animated elements just does not look good, and if that's an indication of the quality of the film, again, why were there so many people booking out movie theaters to see this thing? I don't know. Maybe people are just like really bound and determined to get out of the house. In Canada Awards news, Deep Amita's Funny Boy, which was Canada's submission for Best International Film, did not make the Oscar shortlist. That's too bad, because Canadians like to get awards from American elite organizations. But it is too bad, because, I mean, Deep Amita's a great filmmaker, and she deserves an Oscar for just her body of work. Another movie altogether, Superman. It was announced last week, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's a very talented writer about black culture and the intersection of black culture and white America, he's going to be writing a new Superman movie. And J.J. Abrams is going to produce. Why is this interesting? Well, first of all, there's been rumors for a long time that Warner Brothers has been eyeing Michael B. Jordan to take up the role of Superman, which would be a vast departure, considering that Michael B. Jordan is black, of course. The hiring of Ta-Nehisi Coates, given his oeuvre. He's also written the comic book adventures of Black Panther as well. So it's not like he is inexperienced with the superhero art form. That's a very specific choice, hiring Ta-Nehisi Coates, if he is indeed, if the intention is to indeed make a black Superman for the first time. J.J. Abrams is producing. J.J. Abrams has had a, shall we say, conflicted history with Superman. In the early aughts, he was contracted to write a new Superman movie. This was before Superman Returns. It was in this weirdo time period between the end of production, or the end of pre-production on Tim Burton's Superman movie and the beginning of production on Bryan Singer's Superman Returns, when it just seemed like they were doing anything to try and get a Superman movie going. J.J. Abrams was one of the people that were hired to take a crack at it, and his draft, and I believe it was a first draft too, fell in the lap of Drew McWinney, who was writing under the pseudonym Boriarty on Ain't It Cool News at the time. And Drew McWinney basically tore apart the script and sort of laid it all bare, and was highly, well, let's be kind and say critical. He was highly critical of the script, which almost immediately put the kibosh on the project. I believe Brett Ratner was supposed to direct that eventually, so perhaps it just seemed for a period of time Superman couldn't escape alleged dirtbag directors, which is interesting. So perhaps there will be a change of course. A lot of people are disappointed in this news because they are reading it as a confirmation that Henry Cavill is out as Superman. A lot of people really like Henry Cavill as Superman because there are a lot of people who really like those Zack Snyder movies. I think Henry Cavill has not been, as an actor, has not been well represented by the Zack Snyder DCEU. I mean, say what you want about Justice League, or I should say Joss Whedon's Justice League. But at the very least, it let Henry Cavill's natural charm sort of be projected from the movie. Henry Cavill came across as affable and witty, charming. You know, he's a Superman. In that movie, he's a Superman you want to spend time with, not a Superman you want to cower in fear from, which is, I think, is 9/10 of the problem with those Zack Snyder Superman movies. So it'd be a shame if, you know, there was a Superman movie to be made that didn't let Henry Cavill be his maximum charming self. Because even when he's playing a villain, like in Mission Impossible, he's a charming guy. Anyway, there's a lot of rumor control there, so who knows what might happen. I mean, this could just as easily fall apart as it could come together. Perhaps Warner Brothers is experimenting like they are with the Batman characters. You know, we had a Joker movie that had nothing to do with the DCEU. We have a Batman movie from Matt Reeves coming out that has nothing to do with the DCEU. Ben Affleck is still hanging around because he's going to be in the Flash movie that's supposed to be made at some point. I don't know. All I know is we got a review... All the Boys, Always and Forever. After this break, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Allow her, let her be. Nothing is going well for her, you see. Allow her, let her be. Nothing is going well for her, you see. What she thinks, what she feels, what she does, what she does, what she wants, what she needs. Nothing is going well.
Fingers crossed, I get into Stanford and we never have to be this far apart, okay? I love you, Peter. Always and forever.
Like a lingering fart. Or nay, a bruise that never heals.
Kitty?
I'm just saying, this is a little dramatic, even for
oh
you.
Oh my goodness. Look at these cupcakes.
Okay, I miss him, and with the time difference, I've barely talked to him all week.
Oh my God, the horror.
Is it just me, or is she getting meaner with age?
And more opinionated.
Thank you. Okay, all I know is that I'm glad you guys are both going to Stanford next year because you are not cut out for this long distance thing.
Okay, well, don't jinx it. I haven't gotten in yet.
Maybe you should wait until you hear back from all of your colleges before you make a decision.
Well, Peter's going for lacrosse. It's a great school, and it's perfect. Okay.
And that's a clip from the film To All the Boys, Always and Forever. It is the new movie from Michael Fimignari, and it stars Lana Condor, Noah Centineo, Janelle Parrish, Anna Cathcart, Henry Thomas, and John Corbett. Okay, I am now being joined on the line by Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I'm doing all right.
Oh, well, that was brief.
Sorry, should I extrapolate from that?
maybe, yeah. I mean, maybe people would like to know how great you are.
I mean, great enough, I guess. We're all still living in the same, post-pandemic world, mid-pandemic world, whatever we're calling this.
Mm-hmm. I would call it mid-world, but that sounds like something out of a video game, but...
Mm-hmm. Or from a Stephen King novel.
Yes.
Midworld is the name of the place in the Dark Tower series, which I sadly know because I've been reading all the Stephen King novels, and the Dark Tower ones are not my favorite.
If you think those are bad, you should check out the Dark Tower movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember one year that the year of Stephen King movies coming out was one of my favorite, you know, my most anticipated things of the year. And then I skipped one of the Stephen King movies, being The Dark Tower. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I missed anything.
No, it was fine. and I think they're remaking it for like HBO Max or something anyway.
Yeah, there's a TV show they're talking about doing and or again. I don't know. I don't understand. We're getting a little off topic, but, you know, pretty much all of my time not watching movies or working is reading Stephen King for the last 2 years. So, you know, welcome to my life. But yeah, I really don't like this series. I don't. You know, I'm three books into it, and I'm still wondering why everybody is so crazy about The Dark Tower. I think, one, it's people who don't actually like fantasy, so what they want is a fantastic story in their urban life, because most of the story doesn't actually take place in Midworld. It takes place in Manhattan in a variety of different time zones. But, yeah, so there you go. There's my Stephen King update for the week.
I think also people interpret all the Easter eggs to other Stephen King books as like literary genius.
Oh, sorry. I'm not supposed to laugh at the genius word, am I? I mean, I really like Stephen King, obviously. Why else would I choose to read every single one of his novels? And, you know, I actually own almost every single one that I have read so far. And I have read, I think, 18 novels since I started this game. We'll call it a game. It's like I'm daring myself to finish. And I'm only on Needful Things, which was the last book I ever read by Stephen King up until very recently, because I didn't like any of the books he wrote after that. So I don't really know what's going to happen once I finish this. But if you want to talk about Easter eggs, you can read any of his other novels. I'm reading Needful Things, which is in the Castle Rock sort of place setting. And so many other books either take place in Castle Rock or have characters go to Castle Rock. And then there's also Derry, Maine. And like, his whole world is full of Easter eggs. There's no reason to read Dark Tower for that. I do actually like these books. Doing a great job of telling everybody not to read Stephen King. But I just really want you to go in with your eyes open.
All right, fair enough. We are here, though, to talk about an adaptation of another literary masterwork. To All the Boys I've Loved series, and the third chapter, Always and Forever. And we're once again back in the Candace wheelhouse, along with right next to all things Stephen King. So, Candace, why did you want to review To All the Boys, Always and Forever?
Yes. I've made it two full months without diving back into my well of teen melodrama or horror. The third film in the To All the Boys I've Loved series came out, and I couldn't not do it. I watched the first one, within weeks of it being released on Netflix, and just absolutely loved it. It was so good. And for a person who loves teen melodrama, I found it to be so refreshing, because it really, the first one really didn't sort of fall into a lot of the cliches, which are fine. Like, I don't mind the cliches, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't watch these films. I do love the cliches, but it's refreshing to see something not do that as well, but still hit all of the same beats and the same, you know, give you the same feeling, etc. So the first one I loved. The second one came out just last year at this time. And in fact, I was looking through my memories a couple days ago, and I had been tweeting about having watched P.S. I Still Love You, the second in the series, which I really liked at the time as well. And so this third one was announced to be coming out, and it was just like, this is one, it's exactly what I need. A full year into a pandemic and staying at home. Listeners might remember that I spent all of December watching Hallmark movies, which I would say filled a need for just like mindless feel good movies, but with the Hallmark ones that you can also completely laugh at because they are so utterly ridiculous. So you know, this third one, the Always and Forever, announced coming out February, and I was just like, yes, that's what I need. I need more really well done Netflix young adult like adaptations. And I've never read any of these books, but you know, I'd like to. I have certainly read a few YA novels over the last year as well to fill that same sort of just, you know, it's easy, it's comforting, it's cute. They're mostly, you know, unlike some teen things that I watch, like Riverdale, for instance. their melodrama is really real melodrama. You know, it's about the like, oh yeah, all of these decisions, all of these things are just so important when you're 17 or 18. And now in my 40s, it's like they're really not. So it's comforting to look back at it and realize, I guess. I don't know. That was long and rambly. That's why I wanted to watch All the Boys Always and Forever.
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing that they didn't have to, you know, investigate a serial killer in this third chapter like they do on Riverdale.
Every damn season.
I don't even keep up with what's going on Riverdale. Legacies is my kind of high school show, guilty pleasure. And at least that has, you know, it's a high school of witches, vampires, and werewolves. So at least, you know, at least there's context. Anyway, I have no experience with this franchise because it is not my wheelhouse. But I followed your advice about how to do the quick, easy, dirty, I guess, binge watch of the All the Boys movies, which is watching the first one, skipping the second one, and then watching the third one. And lo and behold, the second one is not necessary to enjoy the third one. Although I do recommend the first one, because I think there is something to that, that feels a bit different, a bit refreshing, has a bit of a different and distinct voice. I think a lot of that is owed to the fact it's a female director. And that's not to say that only female directors can tell female stories, but I think there is a distinct, different, more genuine flavor to that first movie because it's a female director and a female screenwriter and a female main character, and it's her story. And I think that is something that is missed from the third one, because I mean I understand that the second and the third movie were shot relatively back to back, and you could kind of tell because to your point about the pandemic, that at the end when they graduate, the principal calls them the class of 2000, the class of 2021, and of course everyone's sitting there in an auditorium, no distance, no masks. Everyone's cheerful and huggy and happy. Nobody's attending via Zoom. So it's not a prescient work, shall we say, but it is, I guess, maybe aspirational to look at this and consider it, you know, to All the Boys takes place in an alternative universe where they got COVID under control quickly, or where COVID didn't happen. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, I definitely did note the graduating class of 2021. And while I did not think of it in the COVID context, as you just have, but that totally makes sense. I did certainly think of it in the, oh, this movie takes place in the future context. Because, you know, June of 2021 is a few months from now, at least.
I mean, it's theoretically possible there could be graduation ceremonies, but I doubt it'll be
Like that, yeah. Like a good old fashioned graduate. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
But the director, as you mentioned, yeah. So I definitely agree. So that's part of the reason too why I did sort of strongly suggest that you watch the first one, because the first one is very good. And does not take away from this third or even the second, which were both done by the same director, that were also very good, but in a different way. The first one with the I think Susan Johnson is the name of the director. Mm. Yeah, and the thing is that I can't even put my finger on it. Like I couldn't put my finger on it when I was watching it the first time. Or necessarily when I was watching it yesterday, when I did take the time to rewatch all three movies, because why not? And that the first one just, it's so warm, I think, is maybe a good way to put it. It's just, it's warm. As soon as Peter and Lara Jean make their plan, I just, you know, like it's just this magic between the look of the shot, which is, I think I would say the first film is not glossy, mm-hmm. whereas the second and third ones definitely are. They feel a lot more sort of CW teen, like even to the point where in the second one, they start by going on a date and they drive into the city. And so everything is just all like lights and flashy and all that sort of stuff. And none of that is in the first one. So that mm-hmm. that scene with Lara Jean and Peter, it's just, it looks really natural lighting. They're outside. The acting of both of the characters, the actual like plotting out what they're going to do for their contract, and even like right away you can sort of tell that they're starting to connect on certain things and even flirt within this building a contract of pretending to be a couple. Mm-hmm. It just, I'm watching it and then all of a sudden I was like, oh my god, I'm smiling so much watching this. Like I feel awful, you know. I had a migraine yesterday. I watched everything from the prone position on my couch. But yet I was just like, just so smiley watching mm-hmm. the first one. And that, I can't really put my finger on what it was about that. I definitely think obviously that it was the director, and I couldn't tell you what it was that she did specifically that just made it sort of more from a feminine point of view, which is why it's so hard to talk about these things when we talk about how we need more women in leadership and more women making movies and more women doing all these things. It's like, but why? It's like, well, because
yeah,
there's just some intangible thing that you can, that the result is tangible, but the what it is intangible.
Right. I don't know if it's a thing too, where, you know, in the first movie, the dramatic bumps come from, I guess, the anxieties and the concerns about the characters themselves, because, you know, Lara Jean is struggling with her own anxieties about, you know, can real life match the fantasy life she constructs for herself, you know, absorbing a steady diet of, you know, romance novels and 80s teen movies. And is she having real feelings for Peter? Is Peter having real feelings for her? If he is having really real feelings for her, why is he still, you know, so close with his ex-girlfriend? And just, you know, it seems to come from these really kind of mercurial places where, you know, it's about just trying to understand the dynamics of a relationship for the first time. And then in the third movie, it's all about things that are kind of relatively outside of that, like where we're going to go to school, and are we going to go to school together, and can we be apart for a year or 4 years, and like that kind of stuff. That also seems like plot stuff we've seen in a million other teen romance movies do. So it just, there was a very different point of view, or I guess maybe the plot, not the plot, but like the ideas and the concerns and the emotions were coming from a very personal place in that movie, as opposed to being, I don't want to say it's plot heavy, because it's not plot heavy. It's very melodramatic, but there's a lot of inner stuff going on in the first movie, but in the third movie, it seems like it's all outer stuff, because it's all the stuff that's going on with, you know, going to prom and, you know, going, you know, college applications. Do I go to this college or that college? And my dad's getting remarried, and, you know, there's stuff with that. And yeah, my boyfriend's dad is back in the picture. By the way, great Henry Thomas appearance. Once again, tapping into that daddy issues energy that he has been playing with since E.T. But it's, you know,
he was the daddy in this one.
I know that's his evolution as an actor. He was the abandoned. Now he's doing the abandoning.
But yeah, I will say, so Always and Forever, you know, this is like 2 years after they have sort of gotten together in the first film. And at this point they are, you know, they are the perfect couple. They have all the things, they've gone through some things that happened in the second movie that really don't matter to the third, but you know, things have happened and they have gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. And so now they're at this place where they're like the perfect couple, except that now life is coming, right? Everything else that they have no control over is what's coming to sort of shake them up. And it's, you know, it's funny because you say, you know, this one is a common sort of trope or story. And really all three of the films are running very common sort of trope stories. Like the first one is, you know, so it's the fake romance they do to, you know, make other people angry, and then they fall in love. We've seen that a million times. The second one was, you know, past person comes in and is flirty, and it's the, did I make the right choice? And we've seen that a million times. And then even this one, and you know, with this one in particular, I think this one is even more relatable, because not only have we seen that a million times in movies and TV, we've probably also this one is a much more common thing that we would have seen actually living it, you know, whether you know, we had to go through that, like splitting up with your significant other because you're going to college, or we saw our friends do it, because this is a really universal sort of experience, I think. And well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just I was just thinking too, that there is a kind of tread line through the three films, which is that I guess perfect being the enemy of the good, which I think is an expression that's got overused a lot, but I think that's the summation of it, is that, you know, the first film is about her getting over this, you know, the ideas of romance she's developed, where she writes these letters and then never sends them, so they never go anywhere. And she never has to worry about that, and she never has to worry about risking anything or getting attached to anyone. And then, you know, that... I haven't seen the second film. I have a vague idea of what goes on in it, but it's, you know, it's about testing those assumptions. It's like, you took a risk. Was it the right risk? And then we get to this one, and it's like, well, all the risks have paid off, but now there's this next level stuff. And I do like the conclusion she comes to at the end, which is rather pat, but it is I think true in a sense. All these romance things we ingest it, through the culture, they are all about the beginning of something, not about the middle or the ending of something, you know. the movie ends when the couple gets together. The book ends when the couple gets together. It's you don't flash forward to, 20 years later and, you're on the brink of divorce because of life, or it doesn't flash forward to like 50 years later where somebody's on their deathbed and then somebody has to go on for years, or even something a bit more like dire or sullen, like, you end up at different nursing homes because you're so old and you have different health concerns that you're separated that way. It just, that's life. That's not romance. And the film ends with this idea that, I think that, romance is one thing. Life is another. Romance is something you do in life. It is not something that defines your life. And, I guess there's something to that, I mean, it's not necessarily done well through the course of the film, but by the time you get to the end, I think there's something in the ether there that maybe is better explained in the books. I don't know, but there's something to that.
And sort of like just moving away from obviously the romance part of the story, because, there are so many other things too about these films that are good and are sort of a thing that I think made them so popular. So Lara Jean, because we haven't really talked about this, and I'm sure everybody probably knows it if you're like remotely following sort of pop culture, but Lara Jean as the main character is Asian American, and the story also heavily involves her family. She has two sisters, an older sister and a younger sister. Her father, who is a white man, and her mother, who passed away, who is a Korean woman. So her and her two sisters are mixed race. And so, one, the fact that it was an Asian American leading like teen actress was a really big deal in 2018 when the first film came along. And what I really love about it, actually a lot of things I really love about it, but one, it was very important, and they purposely chose three actresses to play sisters who are all mixed race Asian American. Of course, it's a little bit of a challenge. Like it took me some time in the first film, because I was just like, I think they must just be three adopted sisters because they don't look anything alike. Unfortunately, we have one sister who's Chinese American, one who's Vietnamese American, and I'm not actually sure, Anna Cathcart, who plays Kitty, the youngest, I'm not sure what her background is. They look quite different from each other. But I think it's also important, they took the step to say, these are three sisters who are mixed race. We need to hire mixed race Asian American actresses to play them. You got to start somewhere, and they started somewhere. So I think that's really great. The other thing I really like about these films in general is the fact that they are Korean is very important to all three of these girls in their self-identity and within their family. But when they're interacting with other people, has no impact, right? Like they do spend time in these films talking about their Korean background. And I love this movie because it starts with them actually taking a trip to Korea, to visit where I don't think their mom, they don't actually talk about it, but I don't think their mom is a first generation Korean, but she certainly did visit Korea when she was a young woman as well. So I loved that they sort of had that in there, but it's just one of those things that's really nice to see that they can both make, being Korean an important part of Lara Jean's identity without making it a big part of anything else in her life, right? Because it's like that, to me, that's what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to recognize a person's identity and who they are and who and how they choose to live, but not have that make any impact on how we interact with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, no, that's key to mentioning. And I did like that they actually went to South Korea and to shoot that that opening scene, because it is, I think they shoot these in Vancouver because you, a lot of noticeably Vancouver actors in the film too.
Yeah, well, and so similarly with the change from the first to the second and third, definitely the second and third have more money, right? Like,
yeah,
they and you could see that on screen, particularly in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they go to real places because there's by the way, I have to just, speaking of things that have nothing to do with the romance, I have to talk about the affluenza at the school, because the first film, they go on a ski trip for a couple of days, and in this film, they go on a senior trip to New York City on the opposite side of the country.
Yeah, they do say they're from Portland, Seattle. I mean, Portland, I'm pretty sure, has, like, only two socioeconomic statuses, and that's well or not. Nothing in between.
No, it's just it sticks out. Also in like the choice of schools, with like, you know, Stanford being name dropped and NYU and UC Berkeley. So it's like these kids are only going to like the top tier schools. And I noticed too that they're I noticed on the Reddit page for that was discussing this review, they changed the schools from the books, and they were the schools from the books are a little less ambitious because it's like the University of Virginia and the University of North Carolina and things, and like these are the and granted they had to move the location because of when you're shooting in Vancouver, it doesn't look like Vancouver, or it doesn't look like, you know, the East Coast of the United States, and this is something a lot of people nitpicked on Smallville all the time whenever you saw mountains in Kansas, but
yes. I continue to find that terribly entertaining, similarly on Supernatural, where they really only seem to travel to a small group of states that kind of are in the middle of the country and all have mountains, apparently.
That's right. But, you know, so I understand that part of it too, but it just the people who are fans of the books were noticeably perturbed that in the movies it's all Ivy or almost all Ivy, but it's and in the books it was noticeably like people going to state schools. But I digress. It just I felt I had to note that myself there. So I mean, in romance movies there's always this element of wish fulfillment anyway, so I can forgive it. Yeah, I am stuck on. It's the third movie, which is what we're supposed to be here to talk about. Is it's perfectly fine. I think it's perfectly. It hits all the notes it has to know. I feel like there's this a kind of phenomenon now with these adaptations, and I don't have too much experience with. But one of the things I was thinking a lot. Was about the 50 Shades franchise. And I know there's not much connective tissue between these two, but, you know, in terms of the making of them, too, the first 50 Shades movie was directed by a woman, and there was something very noticeable about that, and especially in the way it approached the female half of the couple, because I think Dakota Johnson is very, very good in those movies in a way that, what's his face? Jamie Dornan is not. But because the second and third films are made by a male director and they are made back to back, those seem very much more functional than are really an expression of a director trying to tell a story in a very specific mindset. And I found something similar to All the Boys movies where it may be that factor of the female director. And not making, again, I'm kind of having a thing where I'm like, what if you're not, you know, obsessively following these movies? What if you're not binging them? Because, you know, the third one opens and there's, you know, there's no, I don't need a recap like previously on or anything like that, but just an acknowledgement that stuff has happened. Like, guess, you know, maybe I'm not that big a fan of these movies. And that there was a similar thing with a lot of these franchise movies, that they're kind of built to be bingeable or built to appeal to a fan base. Whereas I like chapters. I like a movie that has a beginning, middle, and end. And that's what it feels like with the first To All the Boys I Loved Before, and we get to this, and it's... Anyway, this is all kind of nitpicky, but yeah.
I will say, though, you know, certainly there isn't a recap, but I do feel like there, throughout the film, there are some sort of tips and clues about what happened in the first one and like how they got there. There's not really very many tips or clues to the second one, because I don't... I still don't think it's particularly necessary. Like, there's nothing that happened in the second one that is important to understanding the third. It's just more story.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, throughout the film, they sort of talk about, you know, having sent the letters and stuff like that. But what they certainly do is a bit of a, like, a montage recap scene towards the end, where basically I'm just like, couldn't you have filmed a little bit of stuff for this montage, not just taken it all from primarily the first film, but also some from the second film? Like, you could have just added a few scenes. We're supposed to believe they've been together for 2 years. Surely we haven't seen all of their relationship on screen.
It does feel like the second movie didn't happen in a respect, and I'm interested to hear you say that, because I thought it was just me watching that montage and like, oh, they seem to have taken all the stuff from the first and third movie. It is almost like the second movie didn't happen.
There are only two shots that they took from the second film, and it was him arriving at the retirement home she was volunteering at the end when they make up in that movie, and the two of them standing outside the treehouse when they hug to make up after their first fight. Maybe they took a third, which was the two of them releasing the Chinese lantern with their initials on it.
Yeah,
but that's pretty much it.
You know what I'm thinking now? It's like, I am going to go back and watch that second movie so to acknowledge it. Because it seems like the makers are kind of retconning that out of it. Like, we have to acknowledge To All the Boys Part 2. It demands to be acknowledged. And I think we shouldn't whitewash the second part of this trilogy out of existence.
I will say it's worth watching for Holland Taylor.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which is a weird pull, really, for a film about teenage... half Asian American woman falling in love with her high school boyfriend, but it is worth watching for Holland Taylor.
The spoiler is the old white woman in the nursing home. Who would have guessed? All right, Candace, if people want to talk more teen romance with you or Stephen King stuff, two very different subjects, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, they can find me anywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. And just one quick thing, if you want to send me all of your photos of John Corbett, all of your videos, all of your GIFs, I would love that, because I think that might have been the best part of the first film for me was John Corbett, and he continued to be awesome throughout all three of them. So send me that old Northern Exposure stuff.
And that will be the last deep cut of the episode.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean. Get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for all the music you hear on End Credits. Just open up your Spotify app and search for End Credits on CFRU and press play. You can also find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca, and you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another episode of End Credits, and we will see you then.